from WBUR Boston and NPR. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Memphis, Tennessee has a rich, tough history of race and culture and power. Slavery and rebel heroes lived in Memphis. Bluesman W.C. Handy, crusading black journalist Ida B. Wells, too. Martin Luther King Jr. died there, assassinated. And on Beale Street, the music played. There's a story in that that explains a lot about the history. It's laced with old-time saloons, cocaine, prostitution, the blues, and a struggle for power. This hour on Point, the story of Beale Street and the soul of Memphis. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you know Beale Street? Do you know its history? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from member station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee, is author and historian Preston Lauterbach. His new book is Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. Preston Lauterbach, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.
And of course, that's the sound of the famous W.C. Handy, father of the blues, behind us right there. I want to put a pause on the music for just a moment and take us to this incredible scene, if you would, at the beginning of the book, where we are on the Mississippi River. It is in the Civil War. This is June 1862. You've got artillery flying, you've got an 800-ton paddle wheel steamer, and you've got a man on the deck of that steamer who has to make a decision, introduce us to this incredible circumstance and man that lies at the root of so much that we know about Memphis today.
Well, the man was Robert Church. He was biracial before biracial was cool. He was the son of a white slave owner and steamboat captain and a slave mother. So picture this. It's the Civil War. He's a Southern man, a slave. He's in the Confederacy. And down the river, here comes the Union flotilla, all of these Yankee gunboats that are there to liberate slaves. And he is one of them. And he sees them coming, and he has an opportunity. He has time to think, well, should I allow myself to be captured by the Union and potentially freed from slavery, or should I escape into the Confederacy, back to Memphis?
Yes.
And so you know what he did? He jumped in the water and swam ashore.
23 years old, a choice sitting in front of them right there. Who knows what was going on in his head as the cannonballs flew. But what do you think that choice meant? His father was the ship's captain, Charles Church. Here he was, biracial, as you say, but both son and slave of that father. How do you think he made his bet on fate in the future there?
I think that he was, above all, his father's son. It was a complex relationship, but it was one that defined Church's duality as a man, and I think he felt better taking his chances on his powerful ancestry than he did the unknown of freedom.
Five Yankee gunboats and two ironclad rams coming down against a rebel fleet of eight river steamboats with the kind of haphazard scrap metal armaments, and over the side he went. He would go on to become the central player in the story of the post-war development of Memphis, Tennessee, that you tell. Give us a sense of how we draw the line from that moment on the deck of the steamship to the Memphis sound, Beale Street, the whole reputation Memphis has in the world today. Give us just a beginning sense of how that unfolded, Preston.
Well, I believe it was a domino effect, a series of unintended consequences that began right there as Church jumped into the water. And by the way, swimming the Mississippi is not exactly the safest choice to get oneself out of trouble either.
Nothing.
I mean, that's a display of his courage, something that you would see throughout his story. But Church was instrumental in developing this civilization on Beale Street. Think about a slave choosing the South to live in, choosing the uncertainty of life in the South after slavery. There was nothing there for them. It had to be created, and that's exactly what Church did.
Why? Let's hold on a second before we dive fully into that and introduce us just to Memphis. Why it sits where it sits, and Memphis antebellum before the war and coming into the war, its place in the South, its role.
It was developed as the capital of the Cotton Empire. It's perfectly situated for trade on the Mississippi River. It's upriver from New Orleans and near enough to right the heart of cotton country. Think about all the cotton being grown in the Mississippi Delta, a little bit over on the Arkansas side, and in rural West Tennessee. So it was really the breadbasket of the Mid-South region. It was connected by rail to Charleston, South Carolina, one of the busiest slave markets. So you had plenty of labor coming into the city and then plenty of economic activity to support that. That's what it was founded as. It was founded as the Cotton Kingdom.
600 miles upriver from New Orleans, maybe 400 or so down from St. Louis, a couple hundred down from Nashville. And it sits on bluffs that protected it from the periodic swelling of the river that let it be.
That's right.
So here we come, and it had some pretty notable figures. We'll go further into the church family, dynasty you call it, but just to give a sense of the powers that swirled around here, another pretty important figure in that time, Nathan Bedford Forrest, the famous rebel cavalry commander, gave the Union all kinds of headaches and hard times during the war. He had plenty of Memphis connection himself.
Highly influential figure in pre-war Memphis, was a slave trader and a city council person. And I think people that are familiar with his accomplishments on the battlefield, being as unorthodox and untrained as they were, that helped to distinguish his character on the battlefield. It was the same way in the city council meetings. You know, when a problem came up of loose dogs running free in the streets of the city, he said that he knew a Mexican who would lasso him up for a dime apiece.
I knew, of course, we all know of the musical history, but the sort of bloody struggles on the way to laying the foundation for that, you lay out early on. This post-war period where the North had emerged victorious, the South was waiting to understand what that meant. Memphis had not been flattened in the war. It had been taken relatively early. Plenty of Union Northerners had moved there. There were black soldiers in the Union Army that were all around Memphis. But still lots of opposition to that and an explosion of violence that you describe in some detail. Share some of that with us. What happened, Preston?
Yeah, you know, the forces at work in Memphis after the war turned out to be far more violent than the war treated the city. So you had this big question after the war, as you said, Tom, what is the South going to be? We call that period Reconstruction. How is this South going to be brought back into the Union as a whole? Nobody knew. You had various schools of thought. Naturally, the Southern people wanted to be left alone. Republican Party in power wanted the opposite. They wanted generally the radical element of the Republican Party wanted a pretty heavy federal presence down there in order to keep things in line.
And so this was Lincoln's Republican Party, which had been which had led the fight against slavery, not the Democrats who in this period were sort of reverse roles perhaps a bit from today.
Oh, I think so. In terms of race and party identity, it's exactly flip-flop, but really only the names have changed. And you're dealing here with not Lincoln's Republican Party, but Andrew Johnson's Republican Party. He was a moderate Tennessean. He was not a radical. So there was just so much uncertainty and conflict, if you can believe this, between the president and Congress. But it played out in the streets of Memphis most violently. You had two representatives of these conflicting schools of thought. One, African-American Union soldiers who came out of the garrison there at Fort Pickering on the bluff. Mm-hmm. On the other side, you had the local police force who were composed largely of Confederate veterans. So if you can imagine that, you've got armed Confederate veterans, armed African-American Union soldiers, and these two sides, both of them like to drink heavily too, by the way, which I don't think helped to calm matters down. Mm-hmm. Late in the afternoon, I believe it was, of April the 30th, 1866, almost a year after, or just over a year after Appomattox, these two sides got into a fight on a street corner, and it got violent quickly. And from there exploded a three-day orgy of blood and fire in which our leading man, Robert Church, was attacked in a saloon that he ran by the police, shot in the head and left for dead as the police drank off all of his whiskey, smoked his cigars, emptied his cash register, and left him there bleeding out.
I mean, you had just an orgy of violence is the only thing to call it. I mean, you literally had rape going on all over the city. You had just pillaging, rampaging forces, utter chaos.
Utter chaos. But I tell you what, I think that the violence is so important to understand. You really, as a reader, somebody who's experiencing the story, you have to feel that violence in order to understand the determination and the need to grow this civilization that did. And I believe that that experience of being nearly killed seared this intensity and determination into Robert Church.
Remember, we have the biracial son of a slave owner in Robert Church. Out of that will grow, well, so much. The Beale Street that we know, the Memphis sound. Preston Lauterbach writes it all up in his new book, Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. Memphis Mini behind us right here in 1938. There was much before we got there. We'll look at the history. Preston, please stand by. In Memphis, great to have you with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I can't fall his own. Take the pillows from under his head. I can fall his own. Take the pillows from under his head. If he don't sleep with me, I'd rather just see him dead.
Put on my blue suede shoes and I boarded the plane. Touched down in the land of the Delta Blues, in the middle of the pouring rain. W.C. Handy, won't you look down over me?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Very popular song from 1991 there, Mark Cohn, talking about walking in Memphis. Beale Street, W.C. Handy, and all the rest, blue suede shoes, Elvis knew those streets, and much more. Historian Preston Lauterbach takes us way back to where all that came from. It's a story of black power, white power, and the super colorful history of Memphis, Tennessee, and its famous Beale Street. His new book is Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. You can join us this hour to hear how directly, openly, by all and every means, the races wrestled for power in this town. Do you hear the stuff of the blues in this story, the wide-open, anything-goes origins of Beale Street, of the Memphis sound? Do you hear the struggle still playing out today in our politics, our economy, our race tensions, our culture? Let's take the sound, let's dial it just a little bit further back. Here's 1929, the Memphis Jug Band. The song, Cocaine Habit Blues, highlights the popularity of the drug in Memphis at that time. The band was active from the 20s to the 50s, made the first popular recordings in Memphis.
Cocaine habit, mighty bad. It's the worst old habit that I ever had. Mr. Lehman's in a low, saw a sign on the window, says no more dough.
Hey, hey, honey, take a whiff on me.
If you don't believe cocaine is good, ask Alma Rose and Julia Wood.
Hey, hey, honey, take a whiff on me.
All right, the Memphis Jug Band is 1929, and we're talking cocaine, a lot of rich history in Memphis. I want to dive right back into it. One call first, Robert in Nashville. Robert, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. About 10 years ago, I had what I consider a really Memphis, quintessential Memphis experience, kind of defined serendipity. I had gotten into a little bit of trouble with the law here in Nashville after I had been at a Al Green concert at the Lyman Auditorium. Of course, Reverend Green is an icon of Memphis music.
Yes.
And long story short, I was about to lose my license for a year, so I decided to take a road trip to Memphis on the 4th of July in 2002 because I was about to lose my license. So anyway, I stayed downtown. I walked to Beale Street, and all the fireworks going off on the Mississippi. I walked all around. I walked to W.C. Handy Park, and there was these old guys playing the blues. So I just sat down there in W.C. Handy, was listening to play the blues for about an hour. They played Howlin' Wolf and Willie Dixon. And I thought after that they finished, I thought, if nothing else happens, this will be a great trip to Memphis.
Yes.
But I was walking down Beale Street, and on the alley, I saw this Elvis impersonator. And he was playing the song Fever. So after he finished playing, he pointed behind the street behind him where the Gibson Guitar Factory was and said, "Hey, Etta." And I asked the bartender, I said, what's he talking about? He said, "Well, Etta James is going to play on top of the Gibson Guitar Factory in an hour." So I love that. Etta James.
Yeah, me too.
And so I rushed over there, got a ticket, and then at the appointed time for the concert, I went up on the roof, and it was just an open-air roof up there. The fireworks were still going off. So she was going to be performing on one end of the roof. I got a metal chair and got on the other end, so I had a line of sight between the two sections of chairs. I was at the very end back, yeah. But I had a great view of her. So anyway, she's playing. Everybody's just loving it, and the fireworks are still going off. Great experience. Just as the fireworks ended over the Mississippi, the smoke from the fireworks was wafting over the roof, and then she started singing At Last.
Oh, Robert, you got Memphis euphoria going on here.
Yeah, that was probably the most sublime experience of my life. And but it just, if ever anybody asks me, what does serendipity mean, I tell them my Etta James and Memphis story.
As good as it gets, just before the law takes that license away, the road trip ends with fireworks and Etta James and the Mississippi. Robert, thank heavens for Southern storytelling and for your call. Preston Lauterbach, take that all the way back to the beginning. Here's Robert with Elvis in the alleyway and the Memphis sound and all the rest. You take us back to the origins of that, out of this bloody tension at the end of the Civil War, and somehow it goes from that black soldiers, white, largely overwhelmingly Irish immigrant policemen, and the emergence of this empire, dynasty you call it, which is really based in the beginning on sex for sale, Preston. How did that emerge?
Well, again, this was Robert Church's, well, the beginnings of the dynasty were not on Beale Street, but they were one street over, one street parallel to Beale Street, where there's no tourist activity or scarcely a building today to speak for it. But as Gayoso Street, mm-hmm. parallel to Beale, was where Robert Church developed the red light district of Memphis. And to give you a sense of how courageous and bold this maneuver was on Church's part. He did not, as an African-American, have African-American staff in these establishments, but he had white staff in these establishments and white customers. And so this was how he divined a stream of income with which to develop this tremendous black civilization.
Let me understand this.
So you had white sinfulness on one street and black civilization one street over. So you got vice underwriting virtue.
He had a white slave-owning father, an African-American slave mother. He was biracial. Did he go as white or black himself in the world?
Well, he very much represented himself as an African-American, but if you look at him, it'd be hard to tell. I think he could have easily gone somewhere else where his name wasn't known and his face wasn't known and could have passed. In fact, that reminds me of there are a number of instances in the book in which, you know, I think you have a sophisticated audience. They're familiar with the concept of racial passing of people
sure.
of African heritage
mm-hmm.
living as white. Well, I found numerous instances in the 19th century even of white people living as African American in order to get into the action on Beale Street.
Wow. Where did Robert Church get the nerve and the power to – he became the South's first black millionaire, as you describe him – but to pull off this very nervy exercise of then an African-American man or one who lived that way in the world running a sex industry of white prostitutes.
Right. I mean, this is during a period in which African-American men were being lynched for having been suspected of looking at white women. And
looking the wrong way. Yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. But I think that a lot of this owes to the white part of his heritage. His father, as we mentioned earlier, was the captain of a steamboat and was the owner of a steamboat line. And so that situated him amongst the most powerful, influential figures in the city in terms of business and politics. And so Robert Church kept a foot in each of these worlds, in the white world and in the black world. His father introduced him to a number of the leading citizens, men who had ridden in Forrest's cavalry, for gosh sake, who became the leading citizens of the city after the war. And so these were Mr. Church's allies. And I would say, Tom, not only that, I mean, from a moral and a legal standpoint, there was absolutely nothing wrong with prostitution during this time.
Well, legally anyway, morally, I guess it's all how you look at it within the context of the time. That culture of prostitution lived on for a long time. Here, this is from 1938, Memphis Minnie singing Down in the Alley, and it's all right there in the lyrics.
I met a man, asked me, did I want a valley? Yes, baby, let's go down in the alley. Take me down in the alley. Take me down in the alley. Take me down the alley, and I'll get my business fixed all right. Well, I met another man, asked for a dollar. Mighty heard that mother by your holler. Let's go down in the alley. Let's go down in the alley. Take me down the alley, I'll get my business fixed all right. Let's go.
Memphis Minnie sings, take me down an alley, I'll get my business, it's all right. Sex was the sort of foundation stone here. Sex for sale. There was plenty more. How did the music come in and get woven through as well, Preston?
You know, this wide open part of the city helped to foster the music quite directly. You know, you had your whorehouse pianists. You had your saloons, which were operated wide open, this being before the era of the jukebox. All of these places hired bands. And so there was quite a demand for music, and the supply came to meet it. There's a very fertile environment, and not only in the saloons, but out on the street corner, some of those musicians out in the park that our caller from Nashville earlier alluded to had ancestors on the street corners before the day of W.C. Handy. So this wide open, really, it sounded like a lot of fun. Wide open, good time, low down place. Fit right in with blues culture and with a thriving music scene.
And then, a couple of decades in, Memphis is hit by an unbelievable kind of natural disaster. Yellow fever comes, and it not only changes the population, it changes the color of the population again.
It became overwhelmingly African American. And I think another crucial ingredient to the Robert Church legend, how he was able to get away with what he got away with, is that he portrayed himself very much as a pillar of society. So there was a time during this fever crisis, during this plague, in which a lot of people wondered if Memphis would exist. And I think the prevailing thought was that it would not be saved. People would abandon it and it would simply cease to exist.
Thousands died, a couple of hundred a day at its worst.
Thousands died. The people that could afford to get away, largely of white skin, got away. And it left an overwhelmingly black population. So two things happened. First, African-American heroism. The black citizens that stayed banded into militias. They protected people's property from looters, you know, who descended into the city to take advantage of the situation, delivered food and medicine to those who were suffering. African Americans, according to the record, enjoyed a certain level of immunity to the fever, and so their casualties were not quite as severe as white people. It didn't hurt them quite as much. Another thing that happened was that there was a movement amongst a few business leaders to revive the city financially. And so there were a series of recovery bonds issued in order to get the city back on its feet financially. And according to legend, the very first of these recovery bonds was purchased by none other than Robert Church, who laid $1,000 down gambling on the future of this city.
The politics come in here in a big way. Kind of at the heart of that in Memphis was David Park Pappy Haddon. Introduce us to him and his relationship with Robert Church and the Church dynasty.
Haddon was an extraordinary figure. I don't know of any white political leader in the 19th century South that so embraced black power as Pappy Haddon did.
He didn't have much choice. It was a black town, right?
Well, that's a good point. And you know what? This is an important point here. Another thing that really set Memphis apart throughout its history, from the Civil War to the Civil Rights Movement, unlike other places in the South, the black vote remained strong and in play throughout all of those years. And so there was always an element of black power, even when the black vote was bundled and exploited as it was. There was always at least an element of black power in the city. And no time was that more prevalent than after the fever, when the population was so overwhelmingly African-American. So yes, you're right. Pappy Haddon was a pragmatist. If he wanted to be in power, he had to recognize African-Americans.
You write that before the growth of the American police state and its attendant prison industrial complex, Haddon made crime pay the city rather than making honest citizens pay for crime. He didn't let the industry go to waste.
Not a bit. He understood that part of the city's identity and an important revenue stream existed in those brothels that Robert Church was running. I believe that he boiled the ethics of the day down very concisely in addressing a couple of prostitutes who were caught riding horseback in the streets too scantily clad and brought before him. See, he also, Tom, even though he had no legal training, he appointed himself as the leader of Memphis as a police court judge. So he saw every criminal that was apprehended by the police in the city, and he told these girls, you know, don't go riding around at night and don't call attention to yourself in a way that makes you look different from other ladies. But since you have violated these rules, you must divide the wages of sin with the city.
So he's doing business. Black politics are up and empowered. Help us understand that the blues starting to emerge and stream into this picture, the origins of it, Preston.
You know, the key figure that is associated with that is W.C. Handy, who, like so many of the characters that I'm fascinated with, is a boundary hopper in the sense that he is an African-American musician, but it was a learned musician. You know, we think of bluesmen as being, you know, old beat-up acoustic guitar-playing guys. Maybe a tooth or two missing. But Handy was the opposite of that. He was very polished, well-trained, accomplished band leader, a writing musician, who used to be the distinction back in the old days between the folk musicians and the learned musicians. Well, he comes to Memphis, you know, fully trained, well-experienced, pretty famous, really, in the early part of the 20th century. And though he stands for, you know, he specialized like in John Philip Sousa type marches. That's kind of stuff that was his stuff in trade when he got to Memphis. But he always had an ear for the street corner preacher and the blind singer and the washerwoman hanging out her clothes and singing while she worked. He loved these folk sources. And so what he did when he got to Memphis, he's listening to the saloon piano players and the roustabouts, you know, loading these bales of cotton down on the river. And it really inspired him as a learned musician. What he did in Memphis was what I think modern audiences would recognize as sampling, which is he took a little bit of saloon piano. Mm-hmm. He took a little bit of street corner verse. And being, as I said, a learned writing musician, he composed these various snatches of folk musician. He quilted them into a musical tapestry, the like of which had never been heard, at least off of Beale Street.
And thence comes the blues. Lots of streams, of course, coming there, but W.C. Handy, eventually known as the father of the blues, coming right out of the Memphis that Preston Lauterbach writes up in his new book, Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. It's a story, in many ways, about black power and white power and the emergence of a culture. Judge Harsh Blues and Furry Lewis behind us here in 1928. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
I ain't got nobody to get me out on bond. I ain't got nobody to get me out on bond. I would not mind, but I ain't done nothing wrong. Please, Judge Harris, make it large your papa kin. Please, Judge Harris, make it large your papa kin. I ain't did no work, Judge, and I don't know when.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes.
My Mr. Crumb don't like it, ain't gonna have it yet. My Mr. Crumb don't like it, ain't gonna have it yet.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about black power, white power, and the super colorful history of Memphis, Tennessee, and its famous Beale Street. Preston Lauterbach is my guest. He joins us from studios of station WKNO in Memphis, Tennessee today. His new book is Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. It happened in a hurry after the Civil War. Black soldiers there, white policemen, lots of tension. Who was going to run things post-Civil War? Big riot. When it was all over, police and mobs had killed, Preston Lauterbach reminds us, 46 people of color. Two white men perished in that rioting. Rape, lots of robberies, 91 houses, 16 schools and churches burned. Up out of that came a new Memphis, a lot of old tensions. But at the heart of it, a biracial man, son of a slave owner, a white slave owner and a slave mother, Robert Church. And the Church dynasty is the dynasty that Preston Lauterbach writes about in his book. You can join us this hour, 800-423-8255. This song, The Beale Street Sheiks, 1927, Mr. Crump Don't Like It, refers to E.H. Crump, political boss in Memphis, ran the city for several decades. Originally written by W.C. Handy in 1912, titled then Memphis Blues. Preston, push us forward here to the Crump, Boss Crump era, and what was happening with racial politics and power then?
Well, it was every bit as extraordinary as that post-Yellow Fever era, simply because by the time Mr. Crump rose to power, really taking over, he built a political machine. It would have been along the lines of Tammany Hall in Memphis. But he built this... Yes, through the saloons and the gambling houses and through the brothels, you know, the traditional avenues to power. But also in conjunction with the son of Robert Church, Robert Church Jr., who rose to prominence in politics. And so while everywhere else in the South had great race conflict at its core, there was in Memphis, I think, a golden opportunity throughout the teens and the 20s with these two powerful, charismatic leaders, Boss Crump and Boss Church, an opportunity to do something in the South which I think would have been totally extraordinary, that is to have a real biracial, bipartisan leadership coalition. And it worked for a while.
Plenty of tension here, plenty of violence, a history, of course, of slavery, but also a different kind of racial politics for decades here with the Church dynasty woven through it. Take a call from Charleston, South Carolina. Camille, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I am deeply, as a woman, offended by your guest cavalier attitude about the state of women, particularly at this time. His subject was the child of rape. His mother was owned by someone. Therefore, there was no consensual sex.
You're talking about Robert Church and his parentage. And, I mean, I don't know if Preston's cavalier about it, but I stand by, Camille. Let me put it to him. Preston, you hear the complaint. You've got a slave-owning riverboat captain, has a son by a slave that he owns, and Camille says, don't be cavalier. This is rape straight up.
Yeah, I mean, I respect her perspective on that. I think the problem with it is that Captain Church, Robert Church's son, well, first of all, we don't know the circumstances surrounding Robert Church's conception. So unless Camille can say for sure that it was a non-consensual situation, then, you know, I don't know what to say about that. But I can say that I don't know how he was conceived. I don't know the circumstances of that. But I know that as a parent, Captain Church was probably pretty extraordinary in terms of white men recognizing, raising, and educating their children. He was on the record as having told Robert Church, don't let anybody call you a N-word. And if you ever have trouble with anybody, stand up for yourself and I will stand beside you.
You're saying this white father had the back of his biracial son. He was strong for him.
Most definitely.
Camille, satisfaction?
No. Did he had his son. Did she have her son?
Ah.
It sounds like a giant mind game he played on this kid. And to say circumstances, he owned her.
He owned his son as well, to be very plain about it. Yeah. Come here, we've got, and he owned his son as well. Do we know what happened with Robert Church's mother, Preston?
Yeah, she died in the 1850s. And so from that point on, Captain Church raised Robert Church on the river. Overall, am I cavalier towards women in this book? No, absolutely not. You will see a figure by the name of Ida B. Wells, who was a product of this unusual environment on Beale Street.
Big figure, crusading African-American journalist who took her message to the whole country.
Absolutely, and spent her formative years on Beale Street in the fertile print culture that took place there. Another, I think, extraordinary element of Beale Street life. Robert Church brought Ida B. Wells back to Beale Street so she could continue her activism, and she really became herself as an anti-lynching activist thanks to Robert Church. Robert Church's daughter, Mary Church Terrell, went on to Washington, D.C. to be a tremendous civil rights advocate. And along with Ida B. Wells was one of the only two women of color to sign the original charter for the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. So, you know, I think that women played an important and sometimes extraordinary role in the history of Beale Street. It's not something I'm cavalier about. But I also, I can't apologize for any of these circumstances. You know, if you don't want your ancestors to appear as scoundrels, then everybody ought to just be nice, right? But it wasn't that way. And I think that the attitudes that prevailed along Beale Street in Memphis and elsewhere morally during this time have to be kept into context. It doesn't matter what I think about them. What matters is that these things happen. It's important to understand the context.
Pete in Reedfield, Wisconsin. Thank you for calling, Pete. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I am just so impressed with all this and fascinated and particularly taken with the grace with which the author handled this last question. But my question has to do with sex and sex and music and sex for sale, if you will, that Tom Clancy evidently said, sex is the most wonderful thing money can buy. And if you look at the Beatles, they came of age, they put in their 10,000 hours in the area of brothels and red light district of Hamburg, Germany. But, you know, I think that the whole issue of prostitution is really an interesting one, and the environment that you have people coming in there and doing stuff on the sly, but I just, you know, I just wonder about the wellspring of musical creativity that might be spawned by sex for sale. Peter, and I'll take my answer off the air.
Yeah, I appreciate your call. Preston, we're not endorsing this most wonderful thing money can buy position. I'm not anyway here. But you look back at the Beatles and where they were in Germany, and, I mean, you get into Funky Town, and you can get some pretty amazing cultural attitudes and music.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that it was all a part of this tremendous culture. You take one important ingredient out of it, and it's hard to see it all coming out the same. But yeah, I mean, I think that delving into this history doesn't condone it, but that's not the purpose of history. We're not here to make everybody feel good about the past. With regard to Pete's question, yeah, absolutely. I mean, listen to Memphis Minnie; she's going down in the alley. So it was certainly a part of Beale Street life and Beale Street culture, and as I noted earlier, financed a lot of the creative activity. So you got to take the bitter with the sweet sometimes.
Here's Jelly Roll Morton on that front. This is from an interview with Alan Lomax, recorded for the Library of Congress, jazz pianist, of course. Talked about the Monarch, a saloon in Memphis where he had played piano, infamously known as the Castle of Missing Men.
They had a piano right into the saloon. Upstairs, they had a dance hall that went maybe once or twice a week. Nothing went into that saloon but pimps, robbers, gamblers. Oh, it's a shame to think about how those environments that I really just drifted into.
Jelly Roll Morton talking with Alan Lomax there of pimps, robbers, and gamblers. and where he drifted. And then just to bring it up to date, here from 2006, here's Beale Street Medley of Memphis Blues, St. Louis Blues, Beale Street Blues, all W.C. Handy songs performed by Joyce Cobb.
The seven wonders of the world I've seen. There are so many places I have been. Take my advice, go see the Beale Street twice. If Beale Street could talk, if Beale Street could talk, Mary Beale would have to pack their beds and walk. Except for a few who never drank booze, and the blind men on the corner singing Beale Street blues. I'd rather be there than any place I know. I'd rather be there than any place I know. It's gonna take the army sergeant for me to have to go.
Memphis jazz and R&B singer Joyce Cobb bringing it all right up to date from the city that Preston Lauterbach writes about in Beale Street Dynasty. Joyce Cobb is with us right now from Memphis, Tennessee. Joyce, thank you so much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom, and I have been really enjoying your show and all of the responses.
You've been singing.
I must say
yes.
That everything must change.
Well, talk about that. You've been in Memphis since the 1970s. Can you still feel this history in the streets, in the clubs, in the culture today, Joyce?
Forever changing, but let me explain to you. I came from a sort of the Republican conservative place called Nashville, home of publishing and home of country and western and WSM and all of its music and writers, to Memphis. I was overwhelmed in 1970s, the latter part of the 70s is when I came to Memphis. It was right on the timeline of change. Number one, it was a change in marketing on Beale Street. When I came to Beale Street in the 70s, it was boarded. It was closed. It was ghost town. Urban Renewal had plans for that area in development, and it never came to be. So it was a ghost town, and an area called Overton Square took its place, and that was where all of the music became prominent in the city. It was Overton Square.
Joyce Cobb is with us. She sings in Memphis, and Beale Street's a major destination today, Joyce.
Yes, it is. Because of the brilliant John Elkington, who decided to take it upon himself as a realtor to redevelop Beale Street. However, the marketing changed. Beale Street was in the past known as predominantly black businesses, black music at one time. And, of course, being that the redevelopment, the marketing changed to a white marketing, aging of 21 to maybe 65-year-old marketing, white marketing.
Yeah.
Also, the open bar policy killed a lot of the bring-your-own-bottle kind of beautiful places of great music, black entrepreneurships of clubs folded because they couldn't compete with the licenses of open bar.
Joyce, let me put one more question to Preston here. Preston, you know, when we think of Memphis later, we think of the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Of course, he was there for a garbage collector strike. Joyce is talking about things that didn't go to black entrepreneurs' way. What happened to the black power that we saw in the heyday of the period you write up, Preston?
I think, as Joyce mentioned, that the real driving force behind change on Beale Street was urban renewal. And what that did, Tom, was to remove, first of all, it removed a lot of the residents from around the Beale Street area. If you go down there now, you'll see the strip of nightclubs, but you'll see bare side streets that used to be, you know, piled high with tenements and apartments. It used to be a real densely urban area, so it's not that anymore because of urban renewal and its failed promise to rebuild those structures that it destroyed. a lot of the African American, so there were the customers, right? The customers were taken out of the picture, and then a lot of the business owners were removed through this really funny thing that they did during urban renewal. The Memphis Housing Authority was in charge of it, and if they wanted to quote unquote renovate or refurbish a business, they would issue a certificate of taking or a declaration of taking. So you had no choice. If they told you that if they declared they were taking your shop, you had to go.
Joyce Cobb, what's your message to the country today when it comes to Beale Street? Is it come on down or something else?
I would say if you want a musical experience, you must start from the Delta, and you must be aware of the great music of America. It starts here, and lots of things are open and alive, and the music thrives, and the food is great. And you need to come and celebrate America in Memphis.
Joyce Cobb, we heard from her 2006 Beale Street medley. I could listen to you all day, Joyce. Thank you so much for spending a couple minutes with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. We'll go out with You May Leave, But This Will Bring You Back, 1929, Memphis Jug Band, Preston Lauterbach. You tell the history in such a beguiling way, and we're grateful for it. Thank you for spending some time with us today.
It's been great. Thank you.
Preston Lauterbach's new book is Beale Street Dynasty, Sex, Song, and the Struggle for the Soul of Memphis. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Thanks for joining us. This is On Point. ¶¶